You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, June 5th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, coverage of the recall battle in Wisconsin. Also on the program, Rachel Grady, producer of the film Detropia, particularly relevant today. Also on the program, Jamie Kilstein, who is attempting to have an exchange with Jonah Goldberg for charity. We will talk about that later in the program. Folks, today, I assume if you are in Wisconsin, you're going to listen to this podcast later, or if you're listening live, you're doing so as you're getting people to vote. If you're listening live today, we have links on the site at majority.fm where you can, there's a couple of different, I think we got Democracy for America and one from the AFL-CIO where you can call from your computer to encourage people to get out and vote in Wisconsin. We also have other resources on there. One that I want you to be sure that you have, if you have any issue at the polls going out to vote in Wisconsin, 1-866-OUR-VOTE, V-O-T-E. I hope you know how to spell that. But even if you don't, confirmed reports that people are receiving robocalls telling them that if they signed the recall petition, their job is done. They don't have to go vote. That is not the case. And when Walker campaign officials were questioned about this, they didn't deny the existence of these calls. They just said it's wrong to blame us for them. Now, you know the figures, we've talked about it. Millions upon millions of dollars poured into this race. 63.5. Total spending on $63.5 million total spending on the Walker recall race. Barrett was outspent 7.5 to 1. So essentially, since January 2011, Walker's campaign raised $30.5 million. Barrett raised $4 million since entering the race in March. And then the rest of that, 29 some odd million outside expenditures, you know, to pay for things like robocalls saying that you don't have to vote if you already signed the recall petition. Thank you, Citizens United. We'll have more on this story. Just a couple of things that I've seen on Twitter. You know, take it for what it's will. The mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, which accounts for 4% of state electorate, looks like it's going to have 10% of the absentee ballots. Now, I that's somewhat encouraging, but remember, Madison is essentially the ground zero of the recall Walker movement. So the real numbers you want to see are coming out of Milwaukee. And polls close at 8 p.m. tonight, Wisconsin time, which I believe is an hour earlier than us on the East Coast. So we won't know until late tonight is my – what's that?
Wouldn't that be an hour later than us?
An hour later. Well, no. There, right now it is noon on the East and 11 a.m. an hour earlier in the day. So it'll be 9 p.m. on the East. Doesn't matter. If you're in Wisconsin, you have until 8 p.m. your local time to vote. It just means that this is going to go late into the evening. And then, of course, Waukesha County, where supposedly we spoke about that election supervisor Nichols yesterday with Amanda Turkle. Supposedly she's not going to be involved in the counting. But I would imagine we're going to hear from Waukesha probably sometime next week, depending on how many votes they have to make up for Scott Walker. All right, we're going to take a break and go and speak to the makers of this film, Detropia, which is not out yet. They're looking to raise money to get it released. I watched the film. Not only is it a beautiful film, but it's very much about stories in the news and Detroit being a bellwether for the rest of the country. It's about unions, issues of cutbacks on transportation. I have a story about that today in my stack. It's a fascinating film. It's not out yet, but I wanted to talk about it. I thought it would be an interesting way to talk about what the issues that are involved in Wisconsin and the destruction of the union movement in this country. Remember, Wisconsin was the first home of public sector unions in the 30s. And Detropia is, well, we'll talk to the filmmaker, and she can tell you exactly what kind of warning it is for the rest of the country. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. I have one of the two filmmakers, the director of this new film, Detropia, Heidi Ewing. Of course, you made this film with your partner, Rachel Grady. Welcome to the program, Heidi.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, just so our audience knows, you, of course, were the director of the Academy Award nominated for documentary, Jesus Camp.
That is correct. Guilty as charged.
And,
Jesus
Camp. Of course, also 12th in Delaware at Sundance. I mean, on and on and on. But let's talk about Detropia. I had an opportunity to watch the film. It's a beautiful film. I have some interest in Detroit. My wife is a filmmaker, a documentary. She did a documentary on Detroit years and years ago. And,
oh, did she?
Yes. Come Unto Me. It was about the Heidelberg Project in Detroit.
Oh, I've been by there many times. It's wonderful.
And the film, Detropia, it's a beautiful film. And talk to me a little bit about why you made this film.
Well, Detroit's my hometown as well. I was born and raised there, and I'm the daughter of a manufacturer. So we always knew the price of steel in my house, and it was always very connected to that industry. And I moved away, but my parents and my relatives all still live there. And going back many times a year over the years, I just noticed a greater sense of despair and a lot more foreclosures and a real downturn in attitude in the city, and started wondering why is Detroit worse off than these other sort of Rust Belt cities around the country. And I really wanted to sort of investigate that and figure out what happened to Detroit and how it can make its way back. And so it just started out as a personal project, a passion project. And then Rachel and I began talking about the city, and we thought, you know what, let's go down there and film a little bit and see what we find. And we became addicted after our first shoot with the personality, the humor, and the sort of world-weary edge that Detroiters have. And we thought Detroiters have a lot to tell the rest of the country. And what's happening in Detroit, you know, started 25 years ago, and it's sort of trickling across the rest of the country. So I think now is a really good time for us to listen to Detroiters.
I mean, the images and the stories, you center the film. Well, I don't know if you center the film, but there are about four or five major characters that you follow throughout the film. One is a woman who blogs and also works at a coffee shop. Another is the president of a local manufacturing union. Another guy owns a bar and was a former school teacher who is reliant upon people who work at the factories. You follow a couple that is doing art, a young couple of artists, all of these different characters represent a different strain of what's happening in Detroit. But let me just back up a little bit. Give me a sense. Because Detroit's been, you know, in trouble, like you say, for 25 years. But it seems in the past 10 years, it's become even more acute.
It has. I mean, you know, this is really a 10-year story. We don't really go too much in the history of Detroit. That would, you know, require like a 10-part series. But in the last 10 years, you know, Michigan has lost 50% of its manufacturing jobs. And the effects of globalization and outsourcing and the realities of this new era, this new economy we're living in, our undereducated population for the jobs that are necessary, et cetera, has really, really hit hardest in the last 10 years. And, you know, Detroit is a place that continues to lose population. And this country is a country that continues to lose ground, you know, when it comes to competition with other nations, sort of the rise of the rest. So definitely it's a living and breathing story. It's things have gotten worse. And I think that, you know, it's really this film and hopefully the city should be a wake-up call to the rest of the country that it's really time for us to sort of act collectively and make some decisions and support these industries so that we don't continue to lose ground. But Detroit is definitely one of those places that, you know, other cities are looking at because it's sunk so low, because it's mired in such problems. If Detroit can make its way back and really have some sort of comeback, then that sort of would give a lot of other places real hope.
It's lost 240,000 residents in the past 10 years, which is a stunning number. I mean,
And it continues to lose population. You know, the mayor likes to say, the mayor Bing, who appears in our film, says, you know what, the exodus is not over. We have to stem the flow.
Right.
It continues to lose population, partly because the school system is in shambles, and the people who are moving to town are, you know, young artists and empty nesters who sort of are looking for some edge and some excitement. But to bring families into the city, you really would need to fix the school system. So again, all the issues that Detroit is suffering, the rest of the country is thinking about as well. And one of the reasons we've launched this Kickstarter campaign to independently release the film is because we really want to bring this message as far and wide as possible starting in September. So we really want the film to come out before the election because we think it's super, super topical to the points that the country is interested in right now.
Yeah, we've got a link at majority.fm to that Kickstarter campaign. Now, the one really poignant part of the film is when the head of this Local 22, who represents workers who are working at American Axle, it's a massive plant, goes back to his members and says, "This is the deal they want to give us." Just talk about that scene, because that scene was just sort of stunning.
It's a heart-wrenching scene, and it's one of those things that it's happening every single day. Well, basically, American Axle, giant employer, had employed over 6,000 people, has moved most of its jobs to Mexico already, and there's one remaining plant left in Detroit City, and the contract was coming up, and the company came back to the membership of the UAW and said, look, basically, take a $3.50 wage cut, $3.50 wage cut on that per hour, in order for us to stick around. And these guys aren't even making a livable wage right now. This is going down to $11 an hour. And basically, they said, take it or leave it. And, you know, some people have this idea of these, you know, big bad unions that got too fat and got too lazy and got too entitled. Those days are over in Detroit, especially since the bailout and since, you know, the craziness that went down in 2009. The union took a 50% wage cut on all new hires. So that the wages are already set at $14 an hour. So that in the scene, they say you make $11 an hour, take it or leave it. And basically you see the shock in these men's faces. How are they going to pay their heating bill? How are they going to – basically, it speaks to the idea, the fact that the middle class is shrinking in this country, and really the working poor is just becoming this massive population in this country. And, you know, obviously they want to keep their job, but they can't survive on these wages. And this is a real issue that a lot of people are feeling the squeeze across the country. It's a devastating scene. In the end, the plant decides to leave and takes the rest of the jobs to Mexico. And that happened while we were filming. This is not something that happened in the past. These decisions are being made by companies today. And so, you know, without some sort of manufacturing base, without some sort of low-skilled labor, a lot of people are just going to be in that breadline.
Let's talk a little bit about the bailout. I don't think, you know, I think there's some appreciation of how the bailout helped these industries. There's some charges on the right, anyway, that the unions got away, you know, like bandits, because they got part ownership.
They became owners, yeah.
Yeah, they got part ownership, but they gave up a tremendous amount. Like you say, a cut in wages for any new hires. They also lost a lot of benefits on the retirement end. How much impact did the bailout have for Detroit? My sense is it had an impact sort of outside of Detroit, but not so much inside Detroit.
You know, it's funny. It's Detroit is like this, you know, metonym for the auto industry, but in reality, there are very few plants operating in the city of Detroit. So the bailout didn't affect employment in the city of Detroit the way you would think it would. However, you know, there are a lot of ancillary industries that make nuts and bolts and screws and all kinds of auto parts that are within the city of Detroit or just outside the city of Detroit. And those would have gone under without the bailout. It's the companies, I think, made out pretty well, and they are selling more cars, and so they're declaring that it was a big success. It hasn't really translated into giant employment numbers. I mean, what was it? 250,000 people lost their jobs before the bailout, and only 25,000, I think, have been hired back. Yep. So it's never going to be what it was. And a lot of these corporations are coming back and are making big profits, but most of those profits, those cars are being made outside of Detroit and often outside of the United States. So it's really, really, it's kind of a murky area to see how much that so-called comeback of the auto industry is translating into real jobs for people.
The other thing that struck me, and we should move on to sort of what the implications are for Detroit. You've got the city is almost like hollowed out. I mean, and you capture that with some, you know, very disturbing and beautiful images of a lot of these amazingly grand buildings that were in, Detroit that are in fact hollowed out in many respects. The city is destroying literally 10,000 standalone houses, and is trying to contract. One of the moments, the really poignant moments in the film too, is when a woman is standing up at a city council meeting, talking about the shutting down of transit lines. Tell us about that moment, because that's a story that's happening. Much of the film is about how Detroit is in many respects a canary in the coal mine. And that dynamic that she expresses is happening all across the country.
Absolutely. There are so many cities in trouble. There are so many cities that can't pay their bills and municipalities that are about to go bankrupt. Detroit very, very nearly averted full bankruptcy a few months ago and went into a consent agreement with the state. Basically, it's being co-managed by the state of Michigan, and it's not the only one. Basically, Detroit is in the midst of shrinking itself in order to survive. There are 140 square miles of land. 40 square miles of that land are completely vacant. What do you do? How do you deliver? How do you pay for trash service and lighting and gas to neighborhoods where there's only one house on a block? It's just a mathematical problem. And so the mayor has been trying to figure out how to encourage residents to move, to leave their homes, to come to a more populated area. You can't force people to do that. It's a real, real conundrum Detroit is trying to solve. And as Senior referred to, more bus lines have been they started to cut more and more bus lines in less populated neighborhoods. And this woman, Stephanie, comes to the mic at a hearing and she says, listen, I make minimum wage. I work every day to improve myself. I get up at 6 in the morning to make it to my job so I'm not late. Please don't take my bus service away. It's all I have. It's my only tether to between me and some sort of functional livelihood. It is an incredibly searing moment, and she speaks for so many thousands of people across this country that are trying to do their best, but their cities are failing them. And honestly, you know, Detroit is just one of many, many municipalities this is happening to, and that's why we really think this isn't a national story.
Of course, you cover this sort of shrinking of the unions, and more than and a couple of people in that film really talk about what's happening with unions. They talk about foreclosures. The UAW, incidentally, has, and I think you obviously know this, has lost almost 42% of its members since 2004.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And,
that's correct.
And we continue to see the shrinking of the base. I mean, you can see it in that one meeting with this guy's having with, like, I keep referring to it, but the look on some of these guys' faces when they're like, why is this company asking us to cut so much of our pay when we're barely making anything, still sticks in my head.
That company has moved to Mexico, and I think it's $3.42 all in Mexico per hour. So it's not even like the guys could take enough of a cut to satisfy the corporation. So really, I mean, some of these companies, I think, have to show some level of patriotism or just practicality. Who's going to buy their products if we're in a country that is mired with working poor that can't afford to even buy what they're producing? I mean, I think it's such short-term thinking on a lot of these corporations and such greed. They're like, if we can pay someone $3 an hour, I mean, these guys have no chance.
I think
we really need to have that conversation.
On that point, you know, I was really struck because the guy who owned the bar towards the end of the film was making that very point, was basically saying, you know, if we've got 2% of the country who are making over $300,000 a year, and then we hollow out the middle class, the whole thing is going to collapse on itself. At that moment, it occurred to me, because we see through the film, and there are protests out at different locations as people are protesting the different cuts that are taking place there. But, you know, here's a guy who's using more or less the refrain of Occupy. I don't know when you shot that that moment, but I wonder if there is if you came across any type of attempts to organize people there and to sort of channel this mass frustration that seems to be felt by the residents of Detroit.
You know what's crazy? We shot that scene, all those scenes, before Occupy even was born. So it was amazing that Occupy really was echoing all of the phrases that people were already saying in Detroit. It was really, really the craziest thing. You know, there are some attempts to organize in Detroit, but I think, you know, I really feel like that movement, if it takes off, is going to take place elsewhere and maybe inspire Detroit. Detroiters are really trying to go about their day, trying to make ends meet, trying to survive. And there, to be honest, there hasn't really been an amazing movement that you'd think to take root in Detroit.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, you know, I mean, on one level, you can almost see it. There's you know, the same forces that are eating away at the fabric of their communities. You know, you've got houses across the street that are abandoned, owned by the city and abandoned, houses next door that are on fire, a lack of services, a disconnect in the community fabric. Is that
Detroit is a very segmented place. Detroit is one of those places that never fully recovered from the riots in the 60s. It's massive. It's hard to get from one place to the next. It's hard to organize. You've got these multiple Detroits that don't talk to each other enough, and that's one of the biggest problems. You've got all these young, fresh, artist-type newcomers coming to the city, moving in, very, very excited, very energetic, and they do a lot together among themselves, but they really don't have enough contact with those lifelong Detroiters. They could really, really use, you know, use a boost and use some sort of organizing factor. So you really, really have these multiple worlds that are not communicating with each other, and it's really, really a problem for Detroit to really come together for that reason.
That's a big racial divide as well.
It's a huge racial divide. The city is, it's over 85% African American. Most of the newcomers are young Caucasian people coming in. And these two groups really need to start talking to each other because I think they could really, really help each other. But it's definitely, I'd say, one of the more segregated cities in the country. And that's really, really hard to overcome.
How has this film been received? I mean, obviously, you haven't don't have any sort of wide public distribution yet, and that's what you're raising the money for on Kickstarter. But I'm curious as to how the people who supported Jesus Camp relative to this, because, I mean, sort of on an ideological spectrum, I would imagine there are similar people who are sort of encouraging of this documentary. Have you found that there's a difference in any way in the way these films are being received?
Well, you know what? We opened, we premiered this film at the Sundance Film Festival in January, and we've been playing the festival circuit ever since. And I'm telling you, every place we go, doesn't matter if it's east, west, south, north. I mean, in Cleveland, they had to add two screenings. There was 1,000 people that couldn't get in. In Toronto, Canada, people were clamoring after the film because it really, really speaks to the anxiety that everyone is feeling right now about the direction of this country. It's not a film just about Detroit. Where are we headed next? How are we going to take some kind of collective action and get past this gridlock, this congressional and political gridlock, to make some decisions as a country? Are there going to be certain industries we support? Are we going to just become a second-rate nation? Are we going to invest in infrastructure or in education? Are we going to invest in manufacturing or care what gets made here? These are major questions that this country is grappling with right now. And I think that's why so far, at least on the festival circuit, there's been a very emotional response to this film, even from, you know, from high school students up to retirees. I've been really, really surprised so far. You just don't know when you make a film who it's going to touch. You hope that it touches people. And the reason that we're deciding to independently distribute this film is because it's the only way we can get it seen in a lot of different markets, including in Canada and the U.S. Most distributors just want to take you to New York and L.A., preach to the choir, and move on with it to DVD. And the reason that we're taking this campaign forward, the Kickstarter campaign right now, is because of the responses so far. They have been impassioned, and that has really given us the energy and the empowerment to get this message out to the people and have community screenings and really try to use this film as a tool, a talking point, to get the people to discuss the anxieties in this country right now and how we're going to solve some of these problems. So it's been overwhelming so far, and we haven't even released it. So we're really, it makes us feel really optimistic. And you know what? The entrepreneurship that Kickstarter encourages is what this country needs and what Detroit needs to move forward. We need a lot of little businesses, a lot of little entrepreneurs. We gotta stop relying on these giant companies and thinking that they're gonna save the day. And that's what I like about this DIY movement and Kickstarter, is that it really promotes entrepreneurship and getting off, you know, your duff and doing it yourself. And so I think it's sort of fitting that the Detroit movie is going on its own like this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. But one thing that was, you know, sort of, I mean, and I mean, there's only so much you can put into a film, but there was sort of a stunning sense that nobody really had any notion of any type of solutions. I mean, you shoot some scenes in the mayor's office where the mayor is talking about how they're going to plan for this or what they're going to do. And there really is just a real sense of, like, you know, never mind, like you say, never mind, healing the patient. How do we just get the bleeding to stop?
You know, I think it speaks to that there are no easy silver bullets. I mean, Mayor Bing, his staff, everyone is doing their utmost. The Detroit Works Project, Dan Gilbert, a local entrepreneur from Quicken Loans, all these guys are getting together, and Phil Cooley, who owns some businesses in the city, they're all getting together and trying to figure out how to solve the problem. I think the fact that we don't have a giant solution that's presented in the movie is because there isn't one thing that's going to save Detroit or these other cities. It's trying a lot of different things. It's shrinking the city. It's trying to get people to move into the city. It's promoting entrepreneurship. It's trying to stop the hemorrhaging at the unions. It's trying to stop companies from taking their business abroad. So many things have to happen on so many levels for a place like Detroit to come back to becoming a functional city that works, and that goes for a lot of other places. And unfortunately, we looked for one great big fat idea, like make the whole place into a giant food producing urban farm. Well, that might happen, but it hasn't yet. It's one idea. So, you know, we didn't want to pretend like there was some easy bow, some golden thing that we can present at the end of the movie is how to fix everything. We didn't find it. Detroit hasn't found it, and America hasn't found it. And so we decided to sort of leave it in a truth-telling kind of way, that the place is open for ideas and in need of ideas. And hopefully, maybe people will come forward when they see this film and sort of join that think tank.
Well, we've got links up to your site and to the Kickstarter campaign. Heidi Ewing, the film is Detropia. Hopefully, folks will have a chance to see it in the coming months on the big screen. It's a beautiful film, and at the very least, within the coming months, I imagine it'll be available via the regular means in which we see films now.
That's right. Look out for it and join our Kickstarter campaign, please. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Heidi. We appreciate talking to you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. Hold on for one second. We should probably wait because we got them in a couple minutes, right? I just wanted to a couple more things to keep your eyes on tonight. As you'll be watching the Wisconsin returns, there are primaries in Montana, New Mexico, and California where Blue America, that's Howie Klein and Digby and Crooks and Liars, have been promoting and supporting genuine progressives going up against Democratic, in Howie's terms, hacks. In California, Democrats, along with many independents and even some Republicans, have completely united around Dr. Lee Rogers in a grassroots effort to oust corrupt shill Buck McKeon. Keep your eyes on those. Norman Solomon is also a progressive that's running that we're keeping eyes on. Nice to get some good Democrats in these primaries. But, of course, the big race in my mind is this recall. Again, a couple of different possible outcomes during this recall. And after we talk to Jamie, we're going to invite calls in from people on the ground in Wisconsin, 646-257-3920. Of course, if you're not in Wisconsin, you can call us as well. We could see the Wisconsin Senate turn to become a majority of Democrats. Again, the damage is done in Wisconsin, but it would at least prevent further damage, at least in the short term. In November, these state senators will be up for re-election again anyways. It's possible the lieutenant governor could be recalled, but the big one is Scott Walker. If you're in Wisconsin, get out and vote right now. We have resources if you want to help. Get out the vote. We have resources on majority.fm. so that you can get involved from sitting in front of your computer. Pretty easy stuff. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jamie Kilstein, who apparently is trying to pick a fight. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. A pleasure to welcome back to this program Jamie Kilstein. Now, of course, around this office, we just refer to him as Allison Kilkenny's lesser half, but it doesn't matter. Jamie Kilstein, folks, welcome to the program.
How's it going? Thank you for having me.
Of course, of Citizen Radio. And
I'm always in the background when you're interviewing Allison, just kind of looking like a puppy at the phone, asking if she wants to talk to me next. And then Allison said, he said next time. And then she hangs up, kind of like when you were a kid and like you wanted to talk to your dad who didn't want to talk to you. And you're like just frantically waving at your mom, like, can I talk? And it's like, Dad, he's busy. I'm like, OK.
Well, this is my way of actually getting back at my own father. That's why I do it.
Now, I think that's why every comedian does comedy, right?
Right, exactly. Of course. Father hate, the central tenet of comedy. Now, now, Jamie, we're all obviously looking to Wisconsin and thinking about that. But in the meantime, what is it about you vegans that are so always looking to pick a fight?
I think after decades and decades of being called weak, we have sort of a chip on our shoulder now.
Wait a second. Now, for people who don't know, tell us the story. This is a function of our old friend Jonah Goldberg here. I say that because, you know, back in, I think it was in 2005, at the Majority Report, I think at one point we took a live chicken. Jonah Goldberg had challenged Juan Cole to a debate. We invited both of them on the program to debate. Only Professor Cole showed up. Jonah Goldberg was AWOL. So we took a live chicken, a raw chicken, and placed it in its seat in lieu of Jonah Goldberg. So we've been familiar with his sort of boastfulness for a long time. But what is it you're responding to?
Sure. Well, he actually, it's funny you bring up the Cole incident, because he actually, ever since this started, he went MIA from Twitter as well for the last 2 days. That seems to sort of be his strategy. He says a bunch of ridiculous shit, and then people call him on it, and then he disappears, and then he comes back hoping people will forget. So essentially what happened this time, I haven't liked him for a long time, and I not just him, but sort of there was this class of rich, entitled Republican white dudes who have pretty much been handed.
Wait a second. Is there a different class of Republicans?
No, maybe not. The majority of white dudes, rich white dudes, who have been handed their own careers. And they've been handed their careers by parents or by, you know, they've inherited it. They've essentially done nothing to earn where they are. Yet those are the people telling us, telling poor kids to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, right?
So now like we should tell, just so people don't know, Jonah Goldberg basically, if it wasn't for his mom, Lucianne Goldberg, who was a big right-wing publisher, she is the one who encouraged Linda Tripp to tape the phone calls with Monica Lewinsky. And Jonah has basically, I think to a certain extent, I'm a helicopter parent too, but Jonah's older than 6 and a half. And so it could be time for him to sort of try and spread his own wings.
Well, there's a huge difference too between like someone who, you know, look, it's, we don't choose who our parents had sex with, right? Like, it's not his fault that his mom did what his mom did. But to then go on and base your career about telling people that they have to pull themselves up by their bootstraps when it's like, dude, your mom and all of her friends were the ones who stole the boots. You know what I mean? Like, don't act like you earned your career, and all of, you know, the 99% of people in America are just, you know, these sort of, like, leeches. But anyway, so he represents that kind of guy. He's advocated the war. I believe that's what the whole coal debate was. It was about the war in Iraq. Defended torture. Alluded to assassinating Julian Assange. And the thing with people like him is no one ever calls him out. When he was wrong about the Iraq war, you should, if you're wrong, if you go on TV over and over again and you cheerlead pathetically for a war you're never going to serve in that ends up killing millions of people, ends up killing more American soldiers than Osama bin Laden did on September 11th, at the very least, you should, like, recuse yourself from television for the next 5 years instead of going on to advocate the next war, to say the war in Iran, when you were so completely wrong on the first one. But these television stations and, you know, besides obviously independent media like you and me and Democracy Now, you know, they keep having these bullies on over and over again. You know, occasionally there'll be the spirited debate where someone like, you know, some Mother Jones guy will yell at him and he'll yell back and nothing really gets accomplished. But they're never really held accountable. And so really recently, Jonah, it showed up on the internet, this video. He was giving a speech, and he said that, this is his quote, "It is a fact of science and nothing correlates closer than stupidity and youth," right? So he's going after, young kids. Now, I know a lot of, dumb young kids. I know a lot of dumb old people. I know a lot of really smart.
Oh, wait a second. Hold on. I want to stop right there too. It's a fact of science. I've never heard that at all, actually. What is the fact of science? That people's IQs are lower when they're younger? I don't get it.
I have no idea. I mean, but that's the thing, right? No one will ever ask these follow-up questions. No one will ever. I mean, this happens all the time in the media where it's like you watch the mainstream news and, you know, opponent A will say, you know, X equals Y, and then Republican B will say X equals X, and then the pundit will say, I guess we'll never know. And it's like, no, just ask a follow-up question. Go on Google. Figure out the answer, you know? And so anyway, so he says that, and then he says, the fact that young people think socialism is better than capitalism, that's proof of what social scientists call their stupidity. Again, quoting these, like, random social scientists, and their ignorance, and it's something that conservatives have to work harder to beat out of them, either literally, and then he, like, panicked and said, or figuratively, as far as I'm concerned.
So he's, here he is, he's saying that we have to beat this, whatever he's calling this stupidity, that there is a perhaps a better economic system out of these people, either literally or figuratively. Now, the generous way that one could look at this is that he's just sort of making a joke to try and make himself seem a little bit more butch. Because let's be honest, you don't look at Jonah Goldberg and go, I'd be nervous to get into, you know, any type of altercation with him, because he really does. I mean, that kid on Mad Men, who's dating the daughter, looks more threatening than Jonah Goldberg. I mean, for a guy who's talking so tough, I mean, it's almost as if he's come from the mean streets, right?
First of all, you just had like 500 people angrily turn off and go, spoiler for Mad Men.
No, I didn't.
You know, I know. yeah, I mean, the thing is, he's a big imposing dude. But he's not, right? Because it's like, again, someone like that, you just look into their eyes, you look at their face, and they just reek of cowardice because no one, again, has ever called them out, you know, and they've never actually had to sort of be held accountable to the things they say. So all I said, I didn't say, hey, I'm going to kick your ass, buddy, or anything like that. I wrote a piece up at Wonkette. Where I said, look, if he truly wants to beat the socialism out of someone, I'm fairly confident I can hold my own. I'm about 4 weight classes below you. I'm a vegan he has gone on record saying that, you know, going out against attacking vegetarians and vegans, saying that, you know, his evidence of why vegetarians are evil is because Hitler was a vegetarian.
Yes, that's not a joke, folks. That's
true. That means that even Hitler, who was like the worst person to ever live, was like, even him, someone was like, hey, you want to eat that chicken? And he was like, dude, that's messed up. Like, that chicken has a family. Like, that's evidence that we're more compassionate. So that's essentially what happened. As I said, look, man, here is your chance if you want to beat the socialist out of someone. And, you know, was he probably kidding? Sure, I believe it. I mean, he came out and said he was joking. But these guys really think they can do things. You know, when we had Glenn Greenwald on Citizen Radio, he told the most incredible story about...
Wait, when you had who on Citizen Radio?
Glenn Greenwald.
Oh, okay.
Who you talked to a bunch. And he told this story about Joe Lieberman going to see... Do you remember that weird, like, action movie with, like, Gene Hackman and one of the Wilson brothers? Behind Enemy Lines.
Right.
And Joe Lieberman... Warhawk Joe Lieberman was in the theater, and this is a dude whose votes affect the country, the world, was in the theater, and every time there would be like an action scene, he would literally just pump his fist and be like, yes! And that's terrifying to me. And the fact that these boys, these little boys, these senators, these warmongering pundits, I mean, that's the lives they live. Jonah Goldberg, in his head, thinks he could beat me senseless. Thinks he could beat most socialists senseless, right? I mean,
do you think he does, or do you think that he imagines himself, like when he has these sort of fantasies of himself as this sort of rough and tumble? I mean, because this is all part of, I mean, look, this guy has to construct a worldview. This guy has to construct his own sort of bio in such a way that it has to ignore the fact that he had just about every advantage one could possibly have if you wanted to end up where Jonah Goldberg is today. I mean, now I agree with you. I had tremendous benefit from my parents, and there are many people who had tremendous benefits from their parents, and you can't fault people for that. But Jonah Goldberg wants to pretend, like you said, that he got there all on his own accord. There was no break that he got that nobody else gets. So he has to construct this whole biography and this whole sense of himself that he really was a tough and scrappy, you know, when he grew up, he wasn't sort of like, you know, coddled. He didn't live in the coddled New York. He lived on the mean streets of the Bowery when he grew up, and he was scrapping it out. And so he probably, in his mind, he probably did think that, like, he's a street fighter, you know, metaphorically. But really. And so
And this is what happens. This is what happens psychologically. I mean, you bring up such a good point where, you know, does he or does he not really think he can beat these people down? And, you know, for years now, I've done mixed martial arts and jiu-jitsu and boxing and Muay Thai and all this stuff. And I can tell you firsthand that when I first showed up at the gym, just like when many people first show up at the gym, they do think it's going to be like the movies where there are so many, like, hacky comedians who are always like, men always be thinking about sex. And it's like, I guess that's sort of true, but I think more than dudes thinking about sex all the time is we are thinking about whether we're in a bank or a restaurant or a subway car. What would happen if somebody came in and robbed that establishment, and how we would defeat them with ninja skills we don't have? Like, I have watched way more martial art movies than I have porn. Like, that is constantly on my mind. And when you first walk into a gym, it's this very humbling experience where you realize that all the things you've pictured you can do in your head, you can't really do. And getting punched in the face kind of sucks, and getting choked out kind of sucks. But what the difference between the people who stick around and who stay in the gym and who bleed and sweat to learn this art form, to learn this skill, and someone like Jonah Goldberg is I train every day during the week except for Sundays, right? And whenever there's a pay-per-view that weekend, a UFC pay-per-view on Monday, all these big kind of meatheads with their tap-out shirts walk in. And, you know they've, like, either gotten into bar fights or fantasized about it. They're like, I want to fight UFC. And then they go in, and they can't jump rope for 5 minutes. For the warm-ups, they go to the puke bucket, they throw up, they leave, they never come back. And you know that when those little mini Jonah Goldbergs left, they just told themselves, instead of going back the next day and being like, that was really hard, I'm going to try to get better, they told themselves, you know, we're in a street fight, I just kicked the guy in the nuts. And that's the kind of person Jonah is, where I truly believe that up until he was called on it, up until he had thousands of people tweeting at him from System Radio, from, you know, Dan Savage posted the petition, Ted Leo posted the petition, a bunch of my favorite UFC fighters posted the petition. You know, once that happened and he actually had to visualize actually maybe going in the ring with someone, he panicked. He wrote his classic.
I was joking.
You know,
Now, to be fair, the guy is, you know, he was nominated, I think, at least twice for the Pulitzer.
I think he also has two UFC titles to his name, is what I heard.
Definitely Pulitzer nominated. Well, I got to say, I'm going to throw this offer into the mix. And people, we have a link to the petition where you can sign the petition. Really, this is just about shaming Jonah Goldberg. But hopefully, maybe he'll show up and you'll raise some money for charity. If you need,
and that's what I wanted to point out really quickly is that again, this was not me threatening him. This wasn't me saying, "Watch your back. I'm going to jump you in a parking garage somewhere." This is, I want it to be a regulated, refereed, 3 2-minute rounds, which is what you'd fight for an amateur fight. I will not be wearing headgear. Jonah can wear headgear. He can wear shin guards. We have regulation boxing gloves on. You know, if it goes to the ground, if there's a submission, you tap out, the fight's over. It's 100% regulated.
Okay.
And like I said, I am just doing
what
you
want. Is legal in New York?
I
don't know if this is legal in New York State. But for the sake of charity, listen, for the sake of charity, if Jonah Goldberg doesn't show up, if my mom or his mom will offer to buy me a bit of a fat suit, I will go in lieu of him.
I'm tweeting this and holding you accountable.
All right. Well, if his mom or my mom will pay for a fat suit, I'm not sure I'm going to enjoy that, but I'll do it for charity. Folks, the petition is on majority.fm. And also, if you want to see the picture of Jonah Goldberg from our debate, you can Google Jonah Goldberg Majority Report Chicken. And you will see the picture. I think it's the first image that comes up on Google. Jamie, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Send Matt my love.
All right, will do. All right, let's take a break. We're going to take phone calls. We got phone calls already on the line. We're going to take a break. This is probably going to be a freebie Tuesday for the Walker recall, because I want to talk to some folks. Hopefully, we'll be talking to some people calling in from Wisconsin. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. I'm holding here in my hand a copy of branded Majority Report coffee, which you can get at justcoffee.coop. Coupon code majority and get 10% off. Donate your account.com/majorityfm. to donate your Twitter or Facebook account for one post a day or less as you choose. Give us a review on iTunes. Buy your Amazon junk through our Amazon link. But it's really your membership that makes this show possible. You can give us a call, 646-257-3920.